World. Thursday, November 14th at 7 p.m., KABU will be showing the 2009 indie classic film, The Yes Men Fix the World. The Yes Men Fix the World is the true story of two political activists posing as executives of giant corporations. In their thrift store suits, they lie their way into big business conferences and pull off pranks. That's The Yes Men Fix the World, November 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm/yesmen2013.
KABU Community Radio is proud to join the Native American Appreciation Club and Mecha Club in co-sponsoring the First University of Portland Powwow, Saturday, November 16th at 1 p.m. Everyone is welcome to come celebrate and honor Native American Heritage Month. There will be traditional Native and Aztec dancers, singers, drummers, vendors, and more. That's the First University of Portland Powwow to take place at the Child Center, 5000 Willamette Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found on the right-hand side of KBOO.FM under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, a climate activist protest here in Portland is interrupting coal industry executives.
An international membership for freedom of expression weighs in on NSA spying practices.
And immigration reform supporters protest in Washington, D.C.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, November 12th, 2013. I'm Nat Parker.
I'm Robert Barncourt. A group of protesters disrupted a meeting of coal industry executives here in Portland this morning to try to bring attention to a planned coal export terminal in Washington State. The protest was organized by Portland Rising Tide, a group which works to fight climate change at a local and global level. Last week, they joined forces with Vancouver activists to shut down the port of Vancouver in order to protest the construction of a new oil export terminal at the port. For more on today's protest, KABU's Rosalind Scott spoke with David Osborne, one of the protest organizers.
Today I'm talking with David Osborne of Portland Rising Tide. Hi, David.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, you bet. I'd like to know what prompted your action at the DoubleTree today and what took place.
Well, today at the Millennium Bulk Terminals, which is the company behind the coal export terminal in Longview, Washington, was making a presentation where they were talking about their project and how green it was. And we felt that we needed to disrupt that because that is very false. And as we have seen recently with the super typhoon in the Philippines, the climate crisis is here, and we simply cannot afford to burn any more fossil fuels, whether it's coal, oil, or gas.
And how many people participated in this action?
Yeah, there was about 40 folks from Portland Rising Tide that came to the DoubleTree Hotel where Millennium Bulk Logistics was making a presentation about their coal export terminal, which would export up to 50 million tons of coal abroad. And we disrupted that presentation because if we're serious about addressing the climate crisis and the social justice implications of it, we can't continue to develop and export any further coal, oil, gas at all.
And what is the potential impact of the proposed coal terminal in Longview, Washington?
Well, that terminal would export up to 50 million tons of coal a year. And so that would obviously have a huge climate impact, and that terminal exists alongside oil, coal, and gas terminals up and down the coast in the northwest in British Columbia. And so in our opposition to this terminal, we're not just trying to stop it, but to stop any new export terminals, because we need to have an immediate cessation of any new fossil fuel extraction and immediately start to reduce consumption rather than increase it by building a terminal such as this.
And I've read that studies have shown that about 500 pounds of coal dust per car would be deposited along the route. Who did this study?
That is a study. I think there's many studies about coal dust. One of the one that I think you're referencing is from Burlington Northern, which is actually the railroad company itself that would be transporting the coal. And we actually delivered a kind of platter of coal dust as a kind of appetizer to the vice president of Millennium Today before their meeting to kind of draw attention to this and the variety of impacts that happen with a project like this. It's not just climate change, but of course, like you're talking about, the dust in communities along the rail lines that would be impacted as well.
Does this go near the Hood River orchards?
This particular route would be coming on the north side of the river, so the trains would come from the Powder River Basin in the kind of Montana, Wyoming area where the coal would be strip mined, and then it would be brought through Spokane and then down through the Columbia River Gorge on the north side to Longview.
And you had an action not too long ago in Vancouver where you had quite a few people turn out, about 1,000 people, I understand. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, there are two things we did recently. And during the summer was when we had the kind of real large action where we had about 1,000 people that came from all across the region that really shows the emerging regional resistance to these fossil fuel projects, which are having a huge impact on the climate. About three times the climate impact of the Keystone XL pipeline would be created by building the coal, oil, and gas terminals to propose. And so 1,000 people came out, and we engaged in a symbolic blockade of the river with about 300 people in kayaks and several hundred on the bridge to kind of demonstrate that we are ready to take nonviolent direct action to stop these terminals if it comes to that, because we simply cannot allow them to be built. And three climbers rappelled off of the bridge and unfurled a banner that said, "Coal, oil, gas, none shall pass," to make that message clear.
What would be the best way for people to contact you if they would like to be involved?
Well, people, if they are interested in getting involved with Rising Tide, it's just to go to our website, portlandrisingtide.org, or to email info@portlandrisingtide.org to hear about things that we're up to. We also have a kind of potluck and celebration party for some of the work that we've been doing, as well as for folks to get a chance to know a little bit more about us. And that is coming up on the 17th of November, and details of that are on our website as well.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, David. And this is Rosalind Scott with KBOO Evening News.
Thank you.
The Keystone XL pipeline is a proposed tar sands crude pipeline that would start in Canada and flow to Texas. TransCanada is questioning the construction and pipeline structure of the Texas pipeline portion because it could cause safety concerns such as oil spills because of dense and sagging portions. Public Citizen recently released a report with detailed information about how the anomalies that they have observed during their investigation. KBOO News reporter Genevieve McDaniel spoke with Tom Smith from Public Citizen in Texas for more information.
I am speaking with Tom Smith from Public Citizen about the Keystone XL pipeline. What is the Keystone XL pipeline?
Keystone XL pipeline is a pipeline that is running from Cushing, Oklahoma, down to the Texas Gulf Coast, and it will pick up tar sands from Cushing and then move them to the Gulf Coast for refining. And we have a lot of concerns about a significant number of excavations along that new pipeline and whether they may indicate significant number of what they're called anomalies or potential problems with the pipeline that are not going to be reinspected unless citizens take some action.
Can you explain what some of the flaws are regarding the pipeline?
They're not so much flaws, because that would apply something with a structural problem with the pipe itself. But when the pipe is laid into the ground, the questions that we're beginning to see are whether or not some of the pipe may have been dented or had problems with sags or had been poorly supported in the trench, or the coating may have been damaged. And these could be areas that would lead eventually to problems later on resulting in corrosion or failure.
What were some of the worst construction violations that you documented?
Well, what we saw that caused us concern, or what our investigators saw that caused concern, were problems with coating being knocked off, dents the size of bricks, sags that would indicate perhaps an inappropriate amount of bending that might end up causing potential failures later on.
How did your group put together the report?
We put together the report because citizens called us and said, hey, we've got people out here digging up the pipeline that they just put into the ground. And so we went and drove along the pipeline and then eventually hired a plane and flew above the pipeline to take a look at it. And in total, counted well over 125 different places where excavations had occurred that may indicate anomalies or problems with the construction and the pipeline.
What are your recommendations for President Obama regarding the Keystone XL pipeline?
Well, we don't think he should approve the northern leg, but on the southern leg, which is what we've been working on, we think that Congress ought to step in and require significant review of the pipeline to make sure that there aren't ongoing safety-related problems with it. And that would include doing reanalysis, both with a high-pressure test called a hydrostatic testing, and then also a caliper inline testing tool that literally goes within the pipeline and does an analysis to make sure there are no internal flaws on the line. And these are the kinds of things that are traditionally done when the pipeline is first tested, but after significant rework aren't required. And we think that it makes good sense that this kind of retesting be done before the pipeline is filled with oil. And part of what's at stake is that this crosses 631 different water bodies, one kind or another, wetlands, streams, rivers in Texas, and could well affect our water quality. And should it break, we're afraid that citizens might be exposed to some of the toxins that we have seen in other pipeline spills in Arkansas and in Michigan in the past 2 years, 3 years now. So that's part of our concern.
What can our listeners do to find out more information or get involved with this issue?
They could go to citizen.org, and our study's up on the website along with a number of pictures. But they could also call their members of Congress and ask them to require an oversight hearing before this pipeline's turned on.
I am speaking with Tom Smith from Public Citizen about the Keystone XL pipeline. This is Genevieve McDaniel with KBOO News.
In the monthly inmate report done by the State Corrections Department here in Oregon, the number of inmates with mental health issues at the Oregon State Penitentiary has increased by 17% in the last 5 years. Now there are approximately 4,700 inmates who are in need of mental health treatment. The usual treatment of mental health issues is through psychiatric medications. The top five crimes that people are sent to prison for here in Oregon are assault, sex abuse, robbery, homicide, and burglary. Although many people end up in prison because of drug-related charges, which this number has increased by over 20% in the last 5 years, over 800 of the inmates mentioned above are over the age of 60, which leads to more expensive medical care overall.
Two men have filed lawsuits against New Mexico police following a series of alleged sexual assaults. In two separate incidents, the men claim that they were subjected to unreasonable search and seizure in violation of their Fourth Amendment rights. Each man was arrested after a canine police dog gave positive indications for drugs during routine traffic stops. The men were then subjected to invasive medical procedures, including anal cavity searches under anesthesia, multiple enemas, x-rays, and CT scans. The procedures failed to return any evidence of illegal drugs and allegedly occurred outside the jurisdiction of issued warrants. A third complainant, a woman who has come forward under conditions of anonymity, also claims that she was subjected to unconstitutional medical procedures, including anal and vaginal probes, under police orders. According to a lawyer from the American Civil Liberties Union, federal authorities did not seek a warrant for the invasive procedures, nor did she grant consent. No disciplinary action has been taken against the accused officers in any of the three cases.
In Seattle's city council election, socialist candidate Kashama Sawant's challenge to Richard Conlon has closed the gap, and both parties are preparing for recount and court challenges. Today's numbers show Sawant with a 41-vote lead. Kashama Sawant had just over 46% of votes tabulated during the first night, but in the following days, when fewer ballots had been processed, she had over 58% of votes counted during the ballot drop processing. Ballot totals announced earlier today may not have resolved the issue because a machine recount is triggered when candidates finish within half a percentage point, which is 2,000 votes, of each other. King County elections must do a manual recount if they're within 150 votes, which is a quarter of one percentage point. After today's latest count, the vote totals show Sawant at 41 votes ahead.
Though many leaders in the U.S. House of Representatives have recently declared the push for comprehensive immigration reform dead, at least for this term, activists across the country say they aren't giving up. Many undocumented people and their allies are calling on President Obama to use his executive power to protect more people from deportation. Others are focused on pressuring Congress. Today, a group of religious leaders and immigrant rights advocates launched an indefinite hunger strike on Capitol Hill, saying they won't eat until lawmakers take action on behalf of the estimated 11 million undocumented people living in the United States. Alice Olstein for Feature Story News has more on this story.
Huddled in a small tent at the foot of Capitol Hill, as near-freezing winds blew outside, a small coalition of immigration activists, union organizers, and faith leaders began a fast aimed at pressuring Congress to pass a long-delayed comprehensive immigration reform bill. Wade Henderson with the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights told reporters Tuesday that the so-called Fast for Families group was following a long line of spiritual and political leaders who used the nonviolent tactic of a hunger strike to advance their cause and share the urgency of their situation.
We have heard the word wait in the past. Dr. King heard it. Chavez heard it. Gandhi heard it. Our communities of immigrants continue to hear it while they bear witness to families divided by deportations, students trapped in limbo bearing the weight of anxiety beyond their years, and workers brutally exploited and relegated to near invisibility. Yet, like them, we refuse to dwell on the frustration of wait. We rise with them and declare our moral obligation, grounded in the words of God spoken through the prophets, to move the compassion of elected leaders in the House of Representatives and to inspire a resilient movement to cease the deportations, suffering, sorrow, and fear, and to usher in a new structure of laws for the good of our countrymen and women, and the sake of our values.
Henderson and the other hunger strikers said they know with just a few weeks left in this congressional term, and with pressing budget deadlines on the horizon, action on immigration reform is extremely unlikely. But Reverend Jim Wallace with the Christian social justice group Sojourners said he's also protesting the political dysfunction and defeatism that makes this the case.
I hear the politicians saying, the commentators saying, it would take a miracle to pass immigration in the next 15 days. Well, we're here praying for a miracle today. In these 15 days, or in January, or in February, we will not go away until this passes. So it's we will win this. In the meantime, so many families are being shattered. How do we protect the media? They're being shattered right now. We have to stop. We are ready right now. We can't wait any longer.
President Obama and many members of Congress have called on the House to take up the immigration reform bill passed by the Senate this summer. But many immigrants' rights advocates have serious concerns about the Senate's bill, especially provisions that would further militarize the border, funnel more people into immigration detention, and expand guest worker programs that have a history of abuse and exploitation. But those participating in the Fast for Families say they're desperate to get some bill, any bill, to move forward, and they can focus on the policy details later.
We're not favoring a particular bill. We want to end this broken system. We want to stop destroying families. We want to bring people out of the shadows. We want to legalize good work. And we want to give people who've been here, lived their lives here, a path to earn citizenship. So those principles have to be part of whatever bill finally passes.
The Obama administration is currently on track to surpass a record 2 million deportations since taking office in 2009. Many activists with the Fast for Families and other actions taking place across the country are calling on the president to use the executive power he has to end or greatly reduce these deportations, especially those of immigrants with no criminal record who have spent decades making a life in the United States. Dai Jun Yoon, a Korean immigrant and Los Angeles-based activist, asked why a president who approved a stay of deportation for many undocumented young people couldn't do the same for their parents and relatives.
How on earth this could happen to a family in America? What kind of national security can be strengthened when we deport hardworking father and school library volunteers? What kind of family value our country or poor when we take away parents from their own son? This must be stopped.
This week, Illinois Democrat Luis Gutierrez joined the advocates' call for President Obama to expand his Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals policy to cover parents of so-called dreamers and anyone else at risk of being deported while they wait for Congress to overhaul the nation's immigration laws. The president has said multiple times that he will not do this, and House Republican leaders have declared immigration reform dead on arrival. But Gutierrez and the fasting activists say it's a question of political will and political pressure. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for an interview after this newscast with KABU's Linda Olson Osterlund from A Deeper Look, as she talks with Arun Gupta, co-founder of the Occupied Wall Street Journal, about Fast Food Fight for 15 movement. This will be followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's Out Loud talks with the creators behind Dexter Flowers' Rock and Roll Camp for Girls, and in-studio appearance from Amy Blue, who will also sample music from her benefit album for Oregon United for Marriage. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's Hard Knock talks about the California foreclosures, as well as the airing of a second part to a Malcolm X speech. Tomorrow's weather forecast is light rain with a high of 52 degrees. And in today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are Beaverton, it's 38 CPM with a high of 52. Damascus, Oregon, has a count of 35 CPM with a high of 39. Powell Butte measures 27 CPM with a high of 34. Seaside, Oregon, has 32 CPM with a high of 41. Hanford, Washington, has 28 CPM with a high of 36. And Sitka, Alaska, has a radiation count of 34 counts per minute with spikes up to 49. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org.
It's 5:25, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Sometimes it pays just to go away. You could ask Jim Skinner about that. He was CEO of the hamburger behemoth McDonald's, pulling down a hefty $8.8 million in pay. Last year, though, Skinner retired, and rather than getting a gold watch, he was given a load of gold, so large that even a Brinks armored truck would have been too small to haul it all away. His salary of $753,000 was the least of it. The Big Mac chain also served up $1.7 million to the chief in stock and $3 million in option awards. Then it slathered on another $10.2 million in retirement pay. All that was topped by a super-rich dessert, $11.6 million in incentive pay. What? Why does a guy with millions already on his food tray need any incentive to do his job? Maybe because Skinner found it hard to stomach the biggest part of his job, which was to pay poverty wages to McDonald's 800,000 workers, shove thousands of them onto food stamps and other programs paid for by taxpayers, and lobby aggressively to prevent any increases in minimum wage or any tax hikes on uber-rich elites like him. It's dirty work, but Skinner did it, finally skipping away with a 2012 pay package totaling $27.7 million. Yet, in the phantasmagoric plutocracy of corporate land, too much is not enough. Last year, for the first time ever, the 10 highest-paid CEOs in America hauled in at least $100 million each, even as the great majority of workaday families have lost income. This is Jim Hightower saying, this gaping and ever-widening inequality is the greatest threat to our society's cohesion. Too few people now control an unconscionable and untenable share of America's money and power, using it to grab more of both for themselves.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Today, the Hawaiian Senate passed the final version of a bill legalizing same-sex marriage. The bill also passed the Hawaiian House last Friday with a 30-19 vote. When the vote was announced, supporters celebrated by waving rainbow flags and chanting, "Love is love," while opponents lowered their heads in prayer. Governor Neil Abercrombie may sign the bill as early as Wednesday morning. The governor has said that he's planning a small invitation-only ceremony for 200 guests who were instrumental in working for passage of this bill. The bill exempts religious clergy and religious organizations from being forced to perform the service against their beliefs, but does not exempt for-profit businesses with religious objections from providing wedding services for gay couples. Starting December 2nd, gay couples can start getting married. Couples with a civil union can go online and change their status to marriage, or they can dissolve the civil union in order to have a marriage ceremony.
The U.S. government has restarted talks this week with European negotiators on a controversial free trade agreement known as the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP. Obama administration officials claim that the new trade agreement will create up to 750,000 new jobs. But fair trade activists point out that similar promises were made about the North American Free Trade Agreement, and the promised jobs never materialized. A coalition of consumer rights, environmental, and indigenous groups have come together to oppose the TTIP, along with its Pacific counterpart, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, known by the acronym as TTP. Or TPP.
A report issued today by an advocacy group that champions freedom of expression suggests that NSA surveillance programs have a chilling effect on how writers work. The PEN American Center surveyed their international membership of writers about the impact those programs have. Their executive director, Suzanne Nossel, discussed the results of the survey and shared her organization's recommendations to remedy the matter with KBOO's Robin Ryan.
We're an organization of 3,600 writers here in the United States and a group of over 20,000 writers around the world who we stand in solidarity with, and we focus on the protection and defense of freedom of expression in all of its forms. So we work on behalf of threatened writers all over the world. We do policy work to ensure that freedom of expression is respected, to push back against encroachments on it.
And how would you characterize the impact of governmental surveillance?
We had a serious concern about what the impact was. We saw polls when Edward Snowden first began to reveal the extent of the encroachment of surveillance. There was almost a sense of indifference on the part of the American public, that many people shrugged their shoulders, that if you looked at polls asking Americans what they thought about it, that their responses were fairly tepid. And we wondered what the situation would be for writers. So we wanted to carry out a survey to ask our members how they felt about these revelations, what their reaction was, how concerned they were about the encroachment on their privacy, and particularly whether they were taking any action in response to those concerns. Were they behaving any differently? Were there any things, any topics that they were refraining from speaking about or writing about?
And did you find a big difference in their response to this dynamic as compared to the general public?
We did. It was very dramatic. In fact, we saw among our writers that they were far more concerned than the public at large about NSA surveillance practices, that they feel that freedom of expression is under threat really as never before, and that in disturbing numbers, about 25% of writers are either now taking action or seriously considering action to curtail the kinds of subjects that they research, that they explore, and that they write about. And so we are already seeing a chilling effect from these revelations just over the last few months.
What would you say surprised you most about the body of the data?
We were surprised by the proportions of writers who curtailed their activities, 20% saying they've curtailed or avoided social media activities, 24% avoiding certain topics in phone or email conversations, 16% avoiding writing or speaking about particular topics. And you think about what are the articles, the books, the ideas that we're not going to read or learn about because people are taking care to avoid certain subjects. That's a tremendous wealth of information, knowledge, insight, and thinking that we're potentially deprived of. And here in this country, a country that's always prided itself on freedom of expression, that's a global leader on freedom of expression, to know that this is happening and really without very much public debate is what's so concerning to us.
Can you talk about what forms you see coming by way of remedies? What were your recommendations?
We focused on the need for far more public scrutiny, transparency, and debate on these programs. We want these programs to be suspended pending a proper review to determine where the boundary line should lie. We're not saying that there is no need for surveillance, but we want to make sure that the proper balance is struck and that there's a national debate and proper legislative scrutiny, review by court, as these lines are moved, that those are conscious, deliberate decisions, and that we're not trading away our privacy and our freedom of expression unknowingly.
I've been talking with Suzanne Nossel, Executive Director at the Pan American Center. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
President Obama today announced the nomination of Treasury official Timothy Mossad to head the little-known Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Citizen advocacy organizations have called for increased regulation of Wall Street trading by the commission and are demanding that the new chairman stand up to Wall Street interests in Washington. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Bart Naylor of Public Citizen.
What is the commission?
The commission regulates arguably the largest market on the planet. These are commodity futures, and it has grown just in the last 10 years from something like $70 trillion to $700 trillion.
And that is the derivatives market, right? A $700 trillion market.
That's right. And while it started, while options started, for example, to calm farmers during the Civil War, that they could enjoy a stable price for the crop that they grew despite the war going on, it has basically grown into what's technically known as the synthetic market, where you simply make bets on prices and nobody ever delivers corn or fuel oil or pork bellies or anything. You're just making a bet about the future price of something. That's, of course, attractive to Wall Street gamblers because there's no paperwork. It's just I win and you lose, and we settle up at the end of the time period.
Now, a $700 trillion market, as you mentioned. In comparison, the U.S. GDP is $16 trillion. So it's...
Yeah, no, it's an absurd number. If you count a million seconds, that's 2 weeks. If you count a billion seconds, that's 30 years. If you count a trillion seconds, that's 30,000 years. It's a number beyond understanding. It's extremely important. It's little known, and therefore, unfortunately, this nominee will face relatively little scrutiny from average Americans. Ideally, if Public Citizen and other progressive groups do its job, we will ensure that this nominee commits to serve real Americans on Main Street as opposed to the gamblers on Wall Street.
What about these high-frequency trades that are disrupting the market? What's being done about those, and what do you think this nominee should do?
Well, too little. I mean, in our view, high-frequency trading, you know, 90% of commodity futures are done by robots. There's no person involved. An algorithm is set to basically sense through complex mathematics what everybody else is going to do. 90% of the trades are also so-called failed. It's like sonar. They ping to see if somebody wants to buy this, but if they don't want to buy it, then they withdraw the trade. In technical terms, it's called a failed trade. This has nothing to do with genuine price discovery. This has nothing to do with giving a farmer in Kansas or Idaho certainty about his or her ability to sell their product. This is just about high-powered gambling. It needs to stop.
What are you advocating for? I know you're calling for this nominee to launch an investigation on the high-frequency trades. Are there other things that Public Citizen is calling for right now?
Well, one of the worst results that affects average Americans is cornering markets, for example, you can see it in fuel prices. There's no reason that the gasoline prices should go from $3.50 down to $2 and back up to $3.25 and so forth. They should respond to demand. And world demand for oil does not flip-flop like that. That's taking place, we believe, because of manipulation and it's very complex. You don't necessarily have to buy all of the oil industry to corner the market. You buy choke points. You buy just certain avenues that you can, through the manipulation, affect the price. Very difficult to prosecute, very difficult to find. You need an agency fully funded to be able to figure that out. You need mathematicians to be able to figure that out. And Matt, you know, MIT physicists now cost a lot of money because they can make a lot more money on Wall Street. So we're up against a big challenge. But yes, we think it's imperative to average Americans that commodity manipulation through speculation be investigated and stopped.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Bart Naylor. He's with Public Citizen. Their website is citizen.org. We've been talking about the nomination today of Treasury official Timothy Massad as the chairman of the U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which regulates the derivatives market. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, November 12, 2013. Israeli soldiers injure 4 civilians and kidnap 4 children during several attacks targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian medical sources have reported that several residents have been injured by Israeli army fire in Hebron City in the southern part of the occupied West Bank, and in Al-Arub and Al-Fuwa refugee camps in the city and Beit Umar nearby town. The sources said that hundreds of residents were marking the 9th anniversary of the death of late President Yasser Arafat when Israeli soldiers violently attacked them, firing gas bombs and rubber-coated metal bullets. The attack took place in Bab al-Zawiya and Tariq bin Zayed areas in the city. Dozens suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation, while 4 were shot by rubber-coated metal bullets. Furthermore, a number of soldiers occupied a rooftop of a home in the center of Al-Arub refugee camp and used it to fire dozens of gas bombs and concussion grenades, leading to dozens of injuries. Several families living in nearby homes had to leave their property due to large amount of gas bombs fired by soldiers. Soldiers also invaded Al-Fuwa refugee camp and fired dozens of gas bombs at local youth who hurled stones at them. Dozens have been treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. Media sources in Hebron said that the soldiers installed several roadblocks at the entrances of Hebron and its nearby towns. Earlier on Tuesday, dozens of Israeli soldiers invaded Al-Ubadiyya town near Bethlehem, southern West Bank, broke into several homes and kidnapped 4 children. All kidnapped children were cuffed, blindfolded, and were moved to Gosh Etzion military base, local sources reported. Furthermore, soldiers invaded Dar Salah village, east of Bethlehem, broke into the home of Ghazi Salah, and handed his 19-year-old son a military warrant, ordering him to head to Gosh Etzion for interrogation. Elsewhere, dozens of soldiers also invaded on Tuesday at dawn the Karyun neighborhood in the old city of the northern West Bank city of Nablus and kidnapped one man. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, November 12, 2013 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Ishmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Listening to the Cable Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We do encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Rosalyn Scott, Genevieve McDaniel, Sam Smith, and Charles Johnson. The producer is Sequoia Wright. Special thanks to Feature Story News. Our engineer holding everything together is Sequoia Wright. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Janka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Nat Parker. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Lisa Loving hosts Wednesday Talk Radio News and Commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9, on Political Perspectives, host Michelle Schroeder Fletcher interviews professor and author Patrick Bratchlinger about his States of Emergency, Essays on Culture and Politics. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, the Dirtbag looks at when and how to harvest persimmon and parsnips and what to do with all those leaves. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent membership drive. You allow KBOO to thrive. And now, stay tuned for a live interview conducted by KBOO's Linda Olson-Osterlund.
Good evening. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund for the report after the news. Thank you for joining us. Around the nation, fast food workers have been heard and seen demonstrating at outlets demanding better wages and working conditions. Portland's no exception. On October 15th, dozens of Portland workers rallied at McDonald's and Wendy's on 29th and Southeast Powell. Organized by Local 503 of the Service Employees International Union as part of a national day of action, the gathering focused on the low wages and poor working conditions faced by workers at these outlets. What you'll hear next is audio from that rally. SEIU Local 503 member Christina Sanders talks about the working conditions she faced working at the McDonald's.
I support all of us in the fact that we need that this corporation, and above many other corporations in the fast food chain, we need to take a look at better wages and better medical plans. I work for this particular McDonald's myself, and my checks were never enough to properly pay bills and buy food and have enough left over. And I really worked really hard at the time, and there was no mercy on sick leave. I'm a mother and with grandchildren. And I was given the hardest jobs to do, cleaning the lobby and cleaning the bathrooms all the time. Never got a chance to really work the register. I think that it's very discriminative on the jobs that they give people. And sometimes I would have to ask for extra time or extra hours to bill between hours. Sometimes I got like 15 hours. I think that the wage should go up to at least $10 an hour. And then they can, you know, I say in my opinion, yes.
That was Christina Sanders, a member of the SEIU here in Portland, speaking at the October 15th rally on Southeast 29th and Powell, talking about the conditions she faced working at McDonald's. As the movement to organize the fast food industry has staged walkouts and one-day strikes, the media has begun paying attention, as you can tell from that clip. Good news for those who support a worker's right to a living wage and decent benefits. Or is it entirely? Joining me in the studio today to talk about the campaign that is coming to be known as the Fight for 15 is Arun Gupta. He's a co-founder of the Occupy Wall Street Journal and a founding editor of the award-winning grassroots New York City newspaper, The Independent. He's a frequent contributor to The Guardian and The Progressive. Thanks so much for joining us in the station this evening, Arun.
Thanks for having me tonight.
So glad that you were here in Portland. It was we would have grabbed you by phone otherwise, but we like you here. You're the author of a just-released article for In These Times, and I guess a companion piece in The Guardian. Mm-hmm. The one in These Times is titled Fight for 15 Confidential. How did the biggest ever mobilization of fast food workers come about, and what is its end game? So, you know, this is not just a brief article or a commentary. This is really an investigative piece with lots of research behind it. You spoke to over 40 people involved in the campaign at all different levels. Tell me what made you turn to go in so deeply to this story.
Yeah, I've been actually working on it since last spring. This is a real investigative report. We poured a lot of resources into it. It took a lot of time. You know, it's not just talking to those 40 sources, much of which involved multiple interviews. Some of them I might have talked to by phone and email 15 to 20 times. And we also got hundreds of internal documents. It was a matter of finding these people. And it came out of a lot of work I've been doing in the last year on low-wage worker organizing and also the living and working conditions. I wrote a chapter called The Walmart Working Class that's going to be out in a book in January 2014, published by Monthly Review. It's the Socialist Register. It's called Registering Class. And so it was there that I started first investigating the low-wage workers and the various movements around it. Essentially, it's because, you know, unions are are dying. There's no way to get around that. Union density peaked in the early 1950s in the private sector at 35%. Overall now, it's about 11.9%. But most of that has to do with there's a much higher concentration in the public sector. The private sector is now down to 6.6%. It's virtually extinct. Now, the thing is, when it was at 35%, it had a lot of power, right? Because even if workers weren't in unions, they were getting the benefits, a spillover effect from unions.
Well, I can remember working in a union cannery versus a non-union cannery, and the wage difference was it was three times greater in the union cannery. And of course, everybody, the only non-union cannery around at that point were on agricultural land itself, so that they could were exempt from the same kinds of wage laws. So I know exactly what you're talking about. The union wages raised everybody's wages.
Mm-hmm. And rights.
And as manufacturing left our country, and there were many attacks on unions and many problems internal to unions themselves, we've seen that decline. So, you know, I never actually expected to see fast food workers organized. It just didn't occur to me because it's such a vastly broken apart industry, and because it didn't look like unions were interested in organizing anything with that kind of low wages. So talk about what you began to find.
Yeah. Well, just to finish that thought, because it's very important. So what is happening is these low-wage workers are being used as a battering ram against public sector workers and against industrial workers. Those are the two last bastions, really, of unions. And it essentially boils down to this. You know, the right and corporations can attack public sector workers in particular with the public at large, because they'll say, hey, why do they deserve a pension when you don't have
government
a pension?
Government employees.
Yeah.
They'll use that. I've had friends even say, well, working for the government. Well, my mom worked for the government.
Right. The whole thing is, you know, it's like they can attack them over the pensions because people in the private sector no longer have pensions. That used to be the norm. So the unions have realized that they need to do something to change the equation. The other part of the factor is we've gotten used to this idea that good wages in industry are natural. You know, that's simply not true. You know, the industrial jobs used to be part-time, low-wage, contingent, horrible conditions, all those things before the upsurge of labor organizing and unionization in the 1930s. Now it's starting to return to that.
Well, including using of children and, you know, every kind of bad labor practice that you could imagine was taking place here in the United States prior to unionization.
And so in the fast food industry, it's estimated there are about 4 million of these low-wage jobs. And then when you look at all the other sectors, discount retailers like Walmart, pharmaceutical, material movers, these are like delivery drivers, warehouse workers, clerks, on and on and on. You're talking about tens of millions of jobs, and these have become the norm. And so unions have to figure out a way. It's become simply a survival mechanism. So what started going on is it's almost exactly a year ago. I think it was November 29th, 2012, when the first strike of fast food workers occurred, and that was in New York City. And this was just, it was like heart paddles to a dying labor movement, right? You know, you had a couple hundred workers marching through the streets, audaciously demanding $15 an hour and unionization. And of course, this is like, well, why the hell not? I mean, New York City, there's incredible wealth. It's a very difficult place to live. Even $15 an hour is a pittance. But these are workers who are surviving on $7.25 an hour, even if they get that, because there's a study that came out earlier this spring that surveyed 500 fast food workers in New York City and found 84% of them were subject to at least one form of wage theft.
Which is one of the other areas that has been part of the organizing. So, Arun, let me ask you this question. The unions turned their eyes to this sector, you're saying, because they needed to, because they didn't have anywhere else to go. But were the workers beginning to resist? Was there any grassroots aspect of this? Were we being? I mean, we certainly saw the Immokalee workers who picked the tomatoes. picketing places. Was there any movement, actually grassroots, that was beginning in these in the fast food industry?
Well, I think, you know, we should make a distinction, right? They're grassroots just means coming up from the bottom.
Yeah.
It's always organized. I talked to one of the leading labor historians about this, Nelson Lichtenstein, and he basically, you know, just... He was like, this whole idea of spontaneous worker organizing, I'm just paraphrasing him, is ridiculous. It's never spontaneous. There's always organization. There's always organizers, even in wildcat strikes, you know, which is when workers themselves go on strike. Even in the 30s and 70s during these waves, there was always organization and organizers involved in it, right? So, but in this case, what's going on is SEIU has been trying to present this as a spontaneous campaign, and this is part of the reason I dug into it, because they were feeding me a line and they were feeding the media a line that it's like, oh, this is a spontaneous kind of bottom-up organizing they were implying. And what we found is SEIU has been very carefully directing this from the get-go. The reason this is important, and as one organizer pointed out to me, SEIU wants to say this is a worker-led movement because they don't want anyone to ask questions. And what they don't want is they don't want anyone to ask questions about what their strategy is, because there is a lot of internal dissension, especially coming from the workers themselves. I interviewed over 20 low-wage workers, organizers, and numerous SEIU members and officials who are essentially saying, look, this campaign is essentially a march on the media. And what they're doing is they're pursuing a legal and PR strategy that is actually undercutting the organizing of workers. In a couple of cities, what we found, Seattle and Washington, D.C., they've been pouring huge resources into trying to organize low-wage fast food workers in these two cities. And what we keep hearing is that their tactics are alienating the workers, because the workers don't have any sort of actual control, that they're kind of, one worker said, you know, we're babied, it's childish. They give us decisions to rubber stamp when it's obvious the decisions are being made elsewhere. Where they're being treated in an instrumental fashion. In other words, it's how many workers can you turn out for protests, for strikes, for meetings before the camera. And so what the workers are saying, this all undercuts the organizing.
So what you're saying is that while there are these wildcat strikes, while there are these strikes and planned walkouts, and they do gain a lot of attention for low-wage workers, that... That what is going on is really an organizing strategy that's leaving out those workers, that's not really taking into account getting down on the ground and working with them. So as this goes forward, because clearly it's going to go forward, and we now have Obama saying he's on board for a $10 an hour wage, many of these movements have sort of come under the headline Fight for 15, the $15 wage. And you're saying, mm-hmm. once again, that was part of the strategy, is mm-hmm. to organize that, even though it looks like they all have different names in mm-hmm. different cities. Mm-hmm. It's really the same campaign. Mm-hmm. So what do you expect to happen going forward? I mean, what do you expect to see now that your article is out and it's stirring up a little bit of controversy about, hey, mm-hmm. you guys in SEIU, maybe you need to get back to work and work with the workers more?
Well, that's the point. The workers, or dozens of them, made themselves, that the really what needs to be done is to build shop floor and citywide militant worker organizations. The power of labor is the power to withdraw its labor. And the way you're going to bring the fast food corporations to the table is not through a legal and PR strategy. It's by gumming up the point of production, by creating enough problems that they decide, like, okay, we'll give them some concessions. But the problem is that the strategy is not really building the type of long-term work organization, because it really looks like SEIU has like a 2 or 3 year game plan, where this is really more needs like a 10-year plan.
Well, thank you for that. I've been speaking with Arun Gupta, author of the article, Fight for the 15 Confidential. How did the biggest ever mobilization of fast food workers come about, and what is its end game? You can find the article at In These Times, a companion article in The Guardian. Thank you so much for joining us here today. We did put in a call to SEIU, invited them to join us in the conversation. We did not hear back from them before airtime. Please do look up the article and listen as you hear this movement going forward. Don't just take what you hear in the media for at face value. And thank you for listening to KBOO Evening News.
45 DJs play
45 RPM records
all day.
Tune into KBOO on November 16th from noon to midnight
for a special 45th anniversary celebration.
DJs will play 15-minute sets of 45 RPM records.
While from noon to 8 p.m., we'll have an open house birthday party at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue with refreshments,
birthday cake, station tours, and more.
So join us November 16th.
In person at KBOO from noon to 8 p.m. and on air from noon to midnight.
To celebrate our 45th year of serving the musical, political, and cultural needs of the Portland metro area, Cascadia, and the world.
For more information, go to kboo.fm/45RPM2013.
Hi, I'm Joanne Hardesty. Join me on November 14th for a stimulating conversation on Voices from the Edge. I will be interviewing John Nichols and Robert McChesney, co-authors of Dollarocracy, a new book on how the money and media election complex is destroying America. Join us from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. on November 14th on Voices from the Edge.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.